Okay, question.
Other than yourself and Cleva, do you know of any other Irish that were at the World Social Forum?
I don't know of any other. I didn't meet any.
This is your first social forum?
Yes.
Yeah. How many were there, and what was it like?
My first impression was that it was an amazing place to be, with so many people gathered, so many different causes, and that there was space for each cause to either protest, have a workshop, and get great backup facilities. In the Royal Court, for example, they were translating what we were saying into several different languages. There was all those kinds of facilities. And there was about 50 food stalls. It was really well organised, but a fantastic huge amount of money went into it. And I was at the opening plenary. We were all gathered. It must have been over 200,000 people in a huge, huge place. A huge stage, music first, and then lots of speakers, including Arundhati Roy, was there that first night. But after 2 days of it, I got completely on overload. I couldn't focus on any one issue. You're getting bombarded the whole time. And even at the World Social, the court that I went to, I found it very distracting that outside we could hear the noise of drums the whole time, and I couldn't sometimes even hear what was going on in the court to speak at. So that's why when I went across to Mumbai Resistance, I found that far more focused, in that all they had was simply loads of bookstalls and some huge tents where the public discussions were taking on, and there was one food counter. So it was very, very basic, and I found it far more focused, and I felt that out of Mumbai Resistance, perhaps they were far more serious on what they were going to do when they left that forum. I found it difficult to understand why the World Social Forum didn't gather those 160,000 people and go and do something strong in the centre of Bombay afterwards, that I wonder what the outcome was of it all. Also, there was some questions about the involvement of NGOs in it, and the questions around whether NGOs are sometimes funded by the imperialists and whether it's their way of undermining the resistance movement. Those things were discussed as well. But just me personally, I found there was too much happening. But I did get to meet lots of people, but it was quite busy.
Your contribution at the forum was about the use of Shannon.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, about our neutrality being breached and why I took the action of damaging a warplane last year. And in fact, I think the speech I made is on Indie Media.
It is. It's up on Indie Media Ireland in the last 2 days under Mary Kelly Reports from Mumbai.
When is your retrial?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It could be in April or June.
Are you calling for people to write to one camera to talk to?
I am. A French politician spoke at one of the workshops on Palestine about the focus there is about the illegal apartheid wall. And he pointed out that Ireland is in quite a powerful position, having presidency of the EU. And he urged people there to write to Brian Cowan within the next week to ask him to put it on the agenda for discussion. But after he spoke, I went up and, you know, spoke about it as well.
Maybe you talked about not receiving that Mary Robinson refused to support you in your action in Shannon. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me what kind of support you would want from someone like Mary Robinson, and what kind of support you would want from the people of Ireland?
Well, I've been reading the Irish Constitution here, and there's a section under Article 13. It's about the powers that the President of Ireland has, and she has quite an amount of power to she's supposed to view the laws that are made and pass judgment on them, on whether they're legal or not. And so the President has quite a responsibility about the upholding of the Constitution according to this Article 13. And I found it extraordinary that as ex-president of Ireland, that she wasn't interested either in upholding the Irish Constitution or international law, because I'm a citizen who my action is trying to get international law upheld here in Ireland, and that Mary Robinson, who's also ex-High Commissioner for Human Rights, that she's not interested in supporting a citizen from her own country who's trying to get that law upheld. So I found that very surprising, that any president of Ireland has this power, and that, as far as I know, she has never spoken out. And when I asked her, you know, and she declined, I pointed out that, you know, I have the support of an international lawyer. I didn't say to her at the time, but I have the support of the ex-US Attorney General, that is Ramsey Clark, who actually travelled to Ireland to help me get international law upheld in Ireland. And he made a statement at my court case in Kilrush last June, and he said if everybody behaved like me, that there wouldn't be any war, that he stood by my action completely. You asked about the support I would like from the people of Ireland. I think it's disappointing that the people who have power are not doing what they should be doing, getting laws supported. The laws are there. None of us who've done actions on Shannon are really breaking the law. All we're really doing civil obedience. We're making sure our laws get upheld. I would ask that more citizens begin to realise that our government and the people in power, and lawyers and barristers around the country, they're not doing a lot. They're not doing very much to help. And I think the onus is on us as citizens. And I think Scott Ritter spoke about that very strongly when he did a talk in Galway last June, and he called on citizens of Ireland to, you know, protect our constitution. He called on citizens anyway to act as good, responsible citizens. So I would like to see more citizens coming out, and just that we forget about looking to politicians anymore, because they're not, you know, doing their job. Yes.
The impression that a lot of people have about Ireland is they associate it with international law, the United Nations, as well as the neutrality. What is it about Ireland that is either changed, or really the question is, why is Ireland afraid, do you think, to stand up to George Bush?
It's possibly because of a huge amount of bullying that is going on, because of the money interests, because of the amount of American investment that has gone into this country, and people are bullied into thinking if we speak up that they're going to pull out their investment. I would say it's largely that reason, that the Irish people are not clinging to the strongest thing we have in this country, which is our history and what we've learned from our history, and that is our own history of occupation and all the lessons we learnt into it. We've been weakened tremendously by a lot of money coming in through the Celtic Tiger and through American investment. We've gone on to the greedy side, and we've forgotten the lessons we've learned through history. That's the only reason I see that we're being bullied. I don't see any other reason. I just think people, money is talking now in this country more than anything, unfortunately.
I have a question, Mary. You had to apply specially to the court to get your passport back in order to be able to travel to India, and apparently the government had taken your passport off you to stop you from absconding from your trial. So you haven't done that, and you've actually come back. Do you think the government are going to be happy that you've come back, or do you think they were hoping that you'd maybe stay away?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I wouldn't think they're too happy to see me come back somehow. I'm certainly going to fight them very strongly in this retrial. They've called for the retrial, and I'm going to fight the case much, much stronger this time, do a much bigger campaign. The last time I hadn't prepared very much in depth, but the expert witnesses that came the last time are all prepared to come again. They've indicated that to me in India. And they feel it's very important that international law gets upheld here in Ireland. And I feel there's a very good chance of it. Even though at the moment there's only a very, very small number of people who see the importance of it and are working very strongly on it. But I feel... I feel this movement will gather momentum. And I feel very hopeful that Ireland will prove to be an example to other countries, and that this small nation of ours will show a way forward by us kicking out the Americans out of Shannon, that other countries will get the courage, you know, to do this. Because more and more evidence is coming out. I mean, only this morning, the ex-UN arms inspector was reported to have resigned from, you know, being inspector into Iraq. And also, you know, there's huge questions still over the Hutton inquiry in the UK. And even questions, did Dr. David Kelly commit suicide? That's the latest thing that I noticed was on the headlines this morning. So I think that in time that those of us that have spoken out and are doing all the work and taking the stand that we've taken will have been shown to be leading a way forward, and that we're on the right track. There's people doing it in other countries as well. Yeah.
Do you think that if it had been British military aircraft down at Shannon, there would have been more of an outcry and an outrage in this country, apart from the government hiding it under the carpet? They wouldn't have been able to do that if it was British.
That's
troops.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it's not just an anti-American sentiment here. Uh-huh. Britain was as deep in this conspiracy to commit genocide as America was.
Mm-hmm.
So you really shouldn't be on trial for uploading an American warplane, because if it had been a British RAF jet or something,
mm-hmm.
the people in this country would have exonerated you, and so would the government.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a kick in the teeth from your own people, really, you know.
I think the Irish people are a bit behind the times. They haven't seen how much we've been taken over by America, and they haven't seen how much that, say, for example, through the Good Friday Agreement, the supposed peace process, that America has got a total grip on this country in terms of bringing in new trade, and a lot of that trade is to do with the arms companies. And Irish people are not up to date with what we're now effectively controlled by America. It was far more blatant when the British were here, but I think it hasn't sunk home yet.
Have any view on the proposed EU constitution? What should be written into it? Safeguard human rights. Maybe the second part would be, what have you a view from any legal sources about the constitutionality of at the time American soldiers going to Airport.
There's a bit of confusion about that at the moment, because those issues were raised in Edward Horgan's High Court case. And even though all those issues were very clearly presented, the findings of that court are not very clear, even though all that... I'm not the best person to ask about this, but those facts have been put on in front of a High Court judge, that our neutrality has been breached. Could I ask Adam to answer you on that? Because Adam knows more clearly what happened about Edward Horgan's case.
My understanding, the judgment in Horgan is many, many pages. But my kind of my personal one-line summary of it would be that he did find very clearly that there was a rule in international law that troops and munitions cannot go across the territory of a neutral country. And that Ireland was, in legal terms, should have been a neutral country. Because there is a constitutional requirement that if Ireland is to participate in the war, the Dáil must agree to it. And the Dáil was not asked to agree to it. So he did find that Ireland, the Irish state, was in breach of its obligations under international law, which is recognised as being requirements on the state in the Constitution in Article 29. However, he found that it was a matter for the executive and not for the courts, and therefore there was nothing he could do about it. That was the judgment, basically, was that Ireland was acting illegally. Parts of the Irish Constitution are only aspirational, apparently. That's part that he had to say that as a quote.
Article 29.
Two subparts of Article 29. He are, according to Justice Kearns, only aspirational and not binding, which is, I mean, I don't understand how a constitution can be a constitutional provision can be aspirational. Anything in the law is supposed to be binding, it's the constitution. And these are actual articles, this is not the preamble, this is actually two parts of Article 29. But it's very, I mean, it's very close to what in I would expect more from a British court hiding behind the royal prerogative. It's basically the same sort of judgment. That was a civil case. It wasn't a criminal case. It was a civil injunction that Hogan was seeking. He did find that was. I mean, although the state claimed to win that case, I think it's significant that the state had to pay half of Ed Horgan's costs and he had to pay none of theirs. Because he did win on one key point. It was just that they decided the court could not see any way for the court to remedy the situation. There's other laws relating to. There are laws against. Sold people wearing military uniform that's not the Irish military. There are laws against foreign soldiers carrying weapons through the state. It all requires to carry any munitions on an aircraft requires the permission. For foreign aircraft to land requires the permission of the government. And Hogan was basically arguing that the government was not allowed to give that permission. The court basically said that they were in breach of international law to give that permission, but the court couldn't see a remedy.
It wasn't seen as such as an act of war that an American came to our airports wearing a military uniform.
It wasn't an act of war by the US on Ireland. It was participation in the US-led war on Iraq by Ireland. So it depends on what you mean by that question.
The
cargo coming through was more significant than the troops. The amounts of cargo that came through. Far more sinister than the troops.
Yeah,
to make
the latest comparison, if a unit of the British Army decided to come down to from north down to Drogheda, wear a military uniform, guns and that, they didn't do anything.
They should be arrested.
Yeah, I've been many times up at the border, even for stepping 3 yards over the border in pursuit of IRA men.
So
British military have been arrested by the Gardaí.
Yes,
British
yes,
military
just making the comparison,
arms.
Just yeah. making it to America, yeah. US military forces and British forces.
Mm.
Yes, but I mean that's because media has been portrayed in this country's media of being anti-American when she's not being anti-American because it's getting involved in the war as well. It just so happened that it was an army plane because the government knew fine well if they had a British helicopter there or a British jet plane there, then there would have been an uproar when in fact the government gave permission to the Royal Air Force of the British military to overfly and protect Irish skies.
So in that case, does Shannon Airport actually have different laws to the rest of the country if you take it logically?
No, they're just being applied differently.
Mm.
The law's the same, it's just being ignored.
But when it gets down to it,
that would be my take on it.
No, it's different laws applying to a different area. That means it's actually in that part of the country.
Well, it's like this, I think. On an international level, it's getting to a stage where there's one law for the whole world, and then there's one law for the American military and the American government, which is no law. No law applies to the American government, and no law applies to the American military. And the Irish government is only recognizing that fact and playing along with it. Now, Mary mentioned the fact that Ireland has been subdued by a barrage of money and that people have been reduced to just sucking on the teat of American money and pacified. But also, I think there's a very good likelihood that the members of this present government and previous governments have been bribed, and not only bribed, but when they won't accept bribes, coerced to accept the situation that now pertains. And the US government and military are not one bit shy about issuing threats of use of force against countries which refuse to cooperate with them and allow the establishment of their bases, which is what Shannon Airport has become. And even this week past, it appeared in the newspaper, in the Herald, a photo of the plane, military plane at Shannon, and the subtitle is Base, colon, da 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 at Shannon. Base. Now it's called a base. Okay? So even the media now are starting to implant in people's minds the idea that yes, it's a base and it's quite normal, there's no complaint, the military base, the US base at Shannon, blah blah blah, get on with your life.
But to add to that, you know, I mean, it was mentioned in the media recently that €15 million has been gathered for the use of Shannon, although it's never really clarified as to whether or not it's just a check or what it was. €15 million is the cheapest military base the U.S. probably has in the world. I mean, I was stunned by that figure. Some people thought it was a lot of money. I don't think it's a lot of money at all.
I would ask, that was the amount Air Asia was supposed to earn. I would be very interested to know how much of that was actually paid by the U.S. military and how much was paid by the Irish taxpayer. Because certainly the parts of the overflight fees
have been waived.
But the air traffic control still needs them, so if we waive them, it effectively means that the government, Irish government, reimburses
taxpayers subsidised.
Or whoever, out of Irish taxpayers. So I would very much doubt the Americans paid up by any means all of that.
Maybe one other question. What is the evidence of military hardware? From your evidence going to Shannon Airport, apart from all military hardware, whether it be guns or other military hardware, what is your evidence that is going to? I know you said you was documented.
Well, that were documents that were disclosed in the Dubsky and Horgan cases.
In the Horgan.
Yeah, where he received the bill of lading the cargo of a selection of aircraft which had gone through Shannon in the past number of years, but only up as far as 2001. As far as I'm aware, that was the last document.
There was an article back in September in the Independent, based on those documents, and I mean,
In the examiner.
Where did these documents come from?
Disclosure in the court case.
Yeah. All right,
now, it was interesting that they had been quite heavily redacted and blacked out parts of them to cover up the names of the companies and the names of the people who were involved in this trafficking of arms. And also, it was apparent from examining the documents that they were falsified somewhat. Because they described, for example, the contents of one jetliner which went through Shannon, Polar Air Cargo, or whatever the name of the carrier was. They had 15 or 44 cruise missile motors. That's what the cargo was described as. But then they have the weight of that cargo in another item, and it was £150,000, right, which is the full of the aircraft. The full capacity of cargo. So basically, they're declaring it as cruise missile motors, but they don't mention the fact that the cruise missile is still wrapped around the motor. Right? Also, they had Patriot missiles going through there, Tomahawk missiles, the cruise missiles, and you can be sure that there's depleted uranium. This has been brought up in the Phoenix because it's a standard part of the military equipment. That they had to get down to Kuwait.
There was an A-10, American Air Force A-10 Warthog plane in Shannon, now they are ground attack, tank busting, they call them aircraft. Their standard load is, I think, 30mm depleted uranium.
That's right.
Cannon. Vicious, vicious looking aircraft. Depleted uranium is radioactive waste made into bullets.
Yeah.
There's probably napalm went through. We know the Americans had napalm.
That's aircraft, right.
The amount, at least a third of the troops and cargo that went out to the Gulf for the most recent attack on Iraq came through Shannon.
And just my last point would be, what if newer military equipment was used in the Iraq war that wasn't used before? And really, different weapons. On the point of view that because of the American economy, a lot of the American economy is driven by military forces as such. When your military does well, the whole economy does well. Those particular companies do well. They employ a lot of people in those particular areas in the States. Should they employ keeping a lot of people in employment? So you can see their point of view of being loyal to those companies, and from their point of view, negating their own ideas about what they should, who they should work for or not work for. But the point about it is, was there any newer, say in the go for the stealth bomber was used for, I think it was the first time, was it? When the stealth bomber was, one stealth bomber was destroyed, there was $1 billion of military hardware that had to be replaced. So that kept, say, I don't know, how many thousand people in employment, and it meant that that particular military company that developed that and made it had to build another one. So, from that point of view, the military machine is needs wars. That's my point of view.
Turnover, in other words. Well, there is a bit of information there because...
what's new? Do you have any information? Well,
for example, it's known that what's called the Mark 77 firebomb went through Shannon. Now, this is essentially napalm, which works a whole lot better than the old napalm, which was basically internationally banned and reviled after Vietnam, and where people saw graphically the effects of it. But they have improved it so that it sticks better to human skin, so that it burns underwater, so that etc., etc., etc. It's much more efficient at killing people. But now when they're asked, yes, you're firebombing villages in Afghanistan and Iraq, but surely napalm is bombed, and the answer the US military gives is yes, of course napalm is bombed, and we would never napalm a village, but we're using the Mark 77 firebomb, which isn't napalm, right? Because it uses a polymer gel as opposed to polystyrene as the sticking agent that gets it to stick to human skin, right? The other thing is, in these wars they like to get rid of all their old stocks. They like to introduce a few new weapons which they can field test, one which they have field tested extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan that we know about is the so-called massive ordnance airburst bomb, which is essentially it's a fueler explosive, which means that in the air the thing pops a huge gas cloud, which is basically aerosolized petroleum, dissipates over an area of about a half a kilometer almost. Then it ignites, and in a split second, all the air in that area is consumed. It has the yield of a small nuclear bomb, in other words, 500 kilotons of TNT. 500 tons of TNT, basically. It's a half a kiloton. And it sucks all the air out, and it just collapses and pops the lungs of any human in a half kilometer radius. So that's the kind of thing they've been using quite a bit in Afghanistan and Iraq. And
most of the new weapons recently have been under very similar names to the old weapons. You know, they had the Patriot missile system they used in Afghanistan and Iraq this time is not the same as the one they used in 91.
Yeah.
Right, but it's still just called Patriot missile. Mm. But
it's improved versions.
Part of the Star Wars DMD system. The cruise missiles again, they'll be upgraded. They'll be the next one up. But they go under very similar names.
Another thing they have extensively tested this time in Iraq is what they call the net-centric warfighting system, which means that all their systems are basically connected up to network with each other, and getting the live feed, having your battlefield system totally computer integrated, so that it's basically just it's like a Game Boy console. It's like almost like playing Doom on a network. And
there was during the Gulf War, particular UK station, and pictures of guided missiles going into particular areas. That was on the news, say, every night, or during that war. So that's a lot of the coverage, the visual coverage that people would have seen about that war, which was considerably similar to computer games that were going around at the time. So the element of voyeuristic, for kids, particularly for children who play these games, it's disastrous. What do you think of the opinion of these, say, you don't have to mention any TV stations, but what do you think of TV imagery on war, say? Have you any opinion of the repetition, the particular images that are chosen?
Well, it's often like war pornography for the viewer. Enjoy seeing the fat and fur fly from some third world sand devil being blown apart by the heroic military who's going to free the world, right? Even the US Army now is developing their own games, like video games, that people can play over the internet, where you can basically join in stamping out the devils. They have it already. And it's used as a tool to recruit. You can't turn on Yahoo. You can't go to a Yahoo group today on the internet without having a lovely animated strip advertising the US military. Join the US military. It sticks in your face the minute you get on the internet.
But it's also important that, I mean, there's the titillation of the attack scenes with the video game cameras and all that. But that's really a mask for what they're not showing at all in the States, which is, you know, it is they have banned all cameras from being on U.S. military bases where the troops, dead troops and wounded troops are coming back.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Bush has yet to appear in public. He's only once gone to a military hospital at all, and he wouldn't even allow any cameras there. So there's an absence of American dead and American wounded.
Mm.
That's it, that's part of it, and that is the mass that we
have. Do you have any figures published at all about how many American soldiers were military people were killed in the war?
It's roughly 550 now.
Yeah, 500.
They just went over the 500 mark of American soldiers killed since the war officially ended.
Right.
That's the kill killing occupation.
But you see, even that's been scandalous because there's a Republican Mississippi congressperson who's certainly no liberal who was looking over the war dead and whatever, and he knew that some of his own constituents had died, and he was matching the list, and he brought it up in the media that the people in his own district that he knew were died in the conflict were not on that official list.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really actually a good question as to like what that number really is, and in terms of the wounded, that's another thing.
So there's over 10,000.
I know during the Vietnam War, there was a particular American, I don't know which stage it was, NBC or ABC, used to have a count every night of many people from Vietnamese were killed, as compared to, say, how many American people were killed. I think it was just Vietnamese people who were killed.
But you see with that, I mean, it is now, you know, what is it, Coalition Provisional Authority, Bremer and his bunch, you know, their policy is not to count the dead. And they've even ordered hospitals now to stop
compiling data,
the media about how many have died.
On the other side, as such,
yeah.
We don't have many figures on
the Iraqi side. They've told the hospitals to stop collecting figures for the number of casualties. On the American side, it's been part of the American cultural experience of war from Vietnam on. It's been photos of the TV footage of troop casualties arriving back at the U.S. military cemetery at Arlington.
Yeah.
And they've banned it. There's been none. They've been stopped from. There's been no. You know that because they know that that's an issue.
Another.
I want to just comment on what you were saying about the way the war is portrayed, and I think if the nitty-gritty realities of war were really portrayed, and it's portrayed like a kind of a game, like those war games, to desensitize us all, but they're not focusing on the children, on what is happening to the children, on what it's like to be living in this terrorizing situation, and they're not focusing on the effects of the depleted uranium on all the abnormalities that have happened because that kind of reporting would just tear people apart. And if that were shown more, I do think people would be far more active. I think there's a way in a very, I don't know, well, how to describe it, but it's very like those war games, the way it's portrayed on television, as if that's normal. But as I say, if what's happening, the children in Palestine, if that was in our face on the television really properly, and the same in Iraq, you know, going back since 91, yeah, I don't think people would be so quiet. I think there'd be a riot.
The other innovation that has occurred in this war is the way that the US and British militaries have begun to manage the media. They started off trying to control what the media would output, but now they're starting to control the actual input of the media by completely monopolizing what they can see, in other words, the press pool and the embedded journalist. So the journalists are made into soldiers almost. Some of them were going around armed in Iraq. If they refuse to join the system and ingratiate themselves with the master's propaganda and reproduce it to the masses, then they are legitimate targets, and this was proclaimed explicitly before the conflict on there started. They said that anyone who doesn't join the press pool, we can't guarantee their safety. But that's like the mafia boss saying, if you don't pay me the money, I can't guarantee your legs don't get broken. You know, so, and yes, they went on to kill an ITN journalist, a couple of Al Jazeera journalists, and several others.
Just a couple of weeks ago, three Reuters journalists picked up out for two or three days and mistreated, at least, should we say, in custody, or by US troops. Reuters have lodged an official complaint, aren't making a fuss.
A Reuters cameraman was also shot dead by the US military.
It was this month anyway. Mm-hmm.
And in Iraq, the Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya TV have been banned, as far as I know. So yes, it's all full spectrum dominance.
Mm-hmm. And say in Iraq, I was watching I think it was NBC. There is an election supposed to happen at some stage. Do you have any information of when the election is supposed to happen?
June, as far as I know.
It's not an election. It's a group of officials that are being appointed by the US, by the College Provisional Authority, by the US in each area. And they will choose the next government. That's the American plan. Because there have been a series of huge protests in Iraq over the last few weeks by people demanding the right to have an election. It's not.
There have been a lot of people shot at these protests as well.
And 2 days ago in The Guardian, Naomi Klein had a really good editorial on what those elections actually are, and they're not elections. They're like, it's so complicated, it's absurd, but they're appointing people to appoint people to appoint people, and there's not an actual vote to be cast. They're going to call it an election. At least that's the current plan, but they didn't change it.
Their argument is that there are voter lists to do proper elections, but I mean, the place has been under sanctions for 10 years, everyone has a food ration card. Still, from you know, that's the list of the population. It's just not got the name voter registration at the top, but it'll do.
Do you know which humanitarian organisations are allowed into Iraq at the moment, or in Iraq?
Quiva Butterley could probably fill you in there better. I don't know.
The World Health Organization is allowed then, but they pulled out a lot of their people because their lives were in danger.
Well, people from the UN are being targeted by the Iraqi resistance because I think
they're being guarded by American soldiers and shown to places where they have to operate from. They can't go into the ordinary population and act humanitarian.
Well, it's actually not very surprising that it's not very surprising that the UN is being targeted, because the UN has shown itself to be nothing but a fig leaf for the American aggression and to cover for it before and in the aftermath. But in the aftermath, they're now totally trying to legitimize the American occupation of Iraq.
I wouldn't speak for Quigley, but I think Quigley would say that Iraqi resistance is plural and it's very complicated. But as an example, it just came out some American newspaper I saw last night, but the CIA is now saying that they fear that Iraq is going to go into civil war, is the next stage of the war. So there's, the U.S. and the Brits are going to be occupying, but there's going to be a civil war, you know, within these different factions. And no one's clear exactly what those factions are, really, but, you know, one faction might be blowing up the U.N. for its own reasons, and another faction might be doing something else for other reasons. And it's kind of hard to speak of it as one.
Well, I tend to think that it might be that the Americans and British will try to steer the Iraqi factions into a civil war against each other, rather than have them unite against the occupiers, which is another possibility that Cleaver mentioned, that if the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims start to unite, then the Americans and British have a very, very big problem in Iraq. So,
really, did the court find, when they were doing the court on the war council of Blair and Bush over mm-hmm. there,
find
them guilty or not guilty under international law?
Oh, yes, they did.
Yes,
yeah.
And will this be taken further? Will there be applications made to try these people under international law at an international court?
There are already, there is an international tribunal underway on US war crimes in particular, and the Japanese have been heading that, and in fact, somebody asked me, would Ireland be interested in having a session of that court happen here? Because they've had several sessions already, and they felt it important that Irish people should be given a chance to give evidence at a session of that court on how our neutrality has been breached and, you know, the illegality of the US using it. So they also felt it might be supportive for my trial as well if a session were to happen here. Or for future trials, yeah. I don't know when it should happen.
Well, I suppose we'll wind it up. Thanks very much.